This is the interview with Bill Hawkins. Talk about your background a bit then, Bill. You were born here in Portland?
I'm a native of Portland.
Native of Portland. Born when?
1936.
36, and what's your education?
Well, local grade schools and high schools.
U.S. Grant or somewhere else?
No, in high school.
Okay, good.
The one on the west side here.
Uh-huh, right.
Then I went to Reed College for 3 years. I started out in a program with MIT, and one thing led to another, and I ended up going to Yale University for architecture. I was there for 4 years. After that, I had a very, very pleasant year in Italy on the Fulbright program connected with the University of Rome. So that was an educational year, certainly. I think, education has certainly gone on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
I think that sums it up.
How long have you been in this firm?
Since about 1966, I think. I got my registration over here in 1967. As soon as I was registered, I was a partner of George and Frank's.
Uh-huh, yeah. And you work largely in restoration, is that fair to say, or not?
We do a great many restoration projects. The largest one was the Pioneer Courthouse, one of the most significant landmarks in the city.
Mm-hmm.
We're now working on the Custom House restoration. It's a bigger project in some ways, and interesting in an entirely different way. But we have a very broad practice. We do a lot of small commercial buildings, small office buildings, classroom additions to churches, small churches and libraries, banks, things like that. But the element that is history is partially comes from George McMath, my partner, who wrote a book on a century of Portland architecture with Tom Vaughan of the Historical Society. And I met George that way. They needed a designer in their firm. That's how I came here. I've certainly had my own interest in this after I took architectural history for almost 8 years. So it's a very much a part of me.
Is that where your passion for cast iron came from?
Oh, no, that came much later.
Yeah? Okay, well, tell me.
Much later.
How did that come to be? Or
well,
where did you first encounter?
I became aware as time went on that Portland had a very unique past in its cast iron. Although most of it had gone, the knowledge of this historic district was very spare. Hardly anybody knew what we had. Of course, these very haunting photographs that Minor White did in the 30s are round, but nothing was ever in one place. You kind of get a feeling of the entire district. When the historic districts, before they were designated, we started a little group called Portland Friends of Cast Iron Architecture with the idea that we would encourage designation of the districts, and we played a small role in that. We would buy artifacts from this period and hopefully put them in a little museum or actually go back onto buildings in the areas down here so that all traces of a very, very dramatic time in Portland's past would not be lost. The little group grew and grew, and we have bought about 150 items. About 350 people have joined in the last 3 years. We just had our third annual meeting for a while ago. But 2 years ago, Margo Gale in New York came out here for a National Trust meeting where she presented us with her book, one of the first copies of it, on New York cast iron. We, of course, are kin spirits across the country. I certainly saw then that a book was a comprehensible feat. And with the help of some very good friends, in particular, Karen Kirtley, who had been an editor at Harcourt Brace in New York. She really was a tremendously enthusiastic person on writing a book. So I, since I had lots of information on the cast iron buildings at that time, I added enormously to that.
Yeah.
And after about a year, I had written the book. The last half was spent mostly in some organization of it and rewriting and indexes, cast iron foundries, that sort of thing.
You're lucky to have that material on foundries, aren't you? That's very valuable.
Well, that It's very unique. Nothing like that's been done before in Portland. There was a student at Lewis College, Michael Brink, who needed a senior thesis project. Mm-hmm. And his professor, Irene Heck, sent him in to visit me. Well, the book hadn't actually started at that point, but I told him it would be very useful information if he were to explore what he could on the foundries. Well, there was absolutely nothing in a library or at the city historical society or anywhere. There was nothing on Oregon foundries, and here it was a major industry in the city. We talked to all the foundries there that are still left. For instance, Willamette Iron Works was a big cast iron foundry, and they are a huge industry now, many, many million-dollar industry. They had no knowledge whatsoever of how they had started. They didn't even know that they had cast all these building fronts. They had never seen the thousands of advertisements in the city directories or the newspapers or whatever. It was interesting to know that a significant part of Portland's past was of no concern to them. So anyway, we were really on our own, and the Historical Society and its city directory lists, and we went through every single one. They have a certain span of newspapers up there. We went through all of those, mainly the building summaries at the end of each year were extremely important.
This is that kind of end of the year review?
Yeah, the end of the year review, where they describe all the major city improvements, and they were very, very proud of them at that time. They were aware that they wanted to have a superior city, simply carving a little city out of the wilderness, but they wanted to do it exceptionally well, and cast iron was a national building material. It was very, very important in the East, and built the Soho District in New York, and of course it played a role in the dome of the Capitol Building in Washington, and Eiffel was to build his tower. There were fabulous cast iron bridges that had been built in England, and all the railway stations were all cast iron. It's a very, very important material of the time. Well, this came to Portland in its building fronts. Unfortunately, the city in its progress urge tore down 95% of what we had with new bridge ramps and improvements along the waterfront and what have you. There was absolutely no appreciation for these buildings, absolutely none.
Which strikes me as kind of odd, because Portland has kind of collected bric-a-brac downtown, the old drinking fountains and so forth, hasn't it?
Well, there is a proper area of historic concern for the establishment. And that would be to send money east to the restoration of a colonial building, or perhaps a building of the 50s like the Bybee Howell House on Sobeys Island. But it was considered not significant to pay any attention to Portland's history. And as a consequence, we've lost a tremendous era of the city and a great deal of charm that we had and a real architectural significance. So I wanted to bring this out in the book to show what we had, first of all, in the history of the men, all the pioneer founders of the city built cast iron front of buildings. All the pioneer names are represented in here.
There literally were just solid blocks of them, weren't there, according to your book? Is that?
Well, in my map on the back, I have every building that was constructed from 1853, which is the year of the first masonry building in the city, commercial building, to 1889, when the cast iron era ended and the sort of Sullivan-esque influence came to Portland. Almost every single building was an iron front building. Now, we have the maps from the old Sanborn fire insurance maps that show all the buildings in various periods. And I have recorded all those standing masonry buildings. And of course, almost all of them had cast iron on them, either structural columns on the main floor or decoration of some sort on them. I have included some that had very little cast iron, but and as part of a general explanation of the city's architectural history.
That
so
that's
the only map that's been drawn. Like this. No one's ever seen a map that had that showed where all the historic buildings were in the city. I had an enormous map that I took photographs which had no street designation on them and tried to tie them to buildings that were either on the Sanborn map as a little block or to annual reports of buildings constructed, slowly evolving a series of names for buildings and locations for them, and relabeling all the photographs where I could. And I began to get a feeling of how this part of the city was constructed. Most of the photographs of the Historical Society are improperly labeled, which wasn't very helpful, but nobody knew any better.
Really, looking at your map here, it was a district about three blocks deep, and
that followed the waterfront.
Followed the waterfront for
now,
what?
Front Avenue
blocks or so?
Was right on the riverbank,
mm-hmm.
except for an area down in here. So the early years, there were nothing but a few shacks built along the bank, and the main row of very small brick, two-story brick, or two or three-story brick buildings with cast iron, the lower floor, were built right along in here.
On front.
And by the 70s and 80s, First had become a major street, and in the 90s, Second and Third was building up
mm-hmm.
to the main streets of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Washington and Alder, Morrison, all these were pushing the city out by the turn of the century.
Right.
But the city was concentrated right down here in about a three-block stretch for, I don't know, about 20, 25 blocks along the river.
Mm-hmm. And then it shifted a little farther west and became terracotta, didn't it?
Sullivan
and terracotta.
What would have been terribly interesting if we'd had the wisdom to keep it would be to show the city's development from to leave the interesting buildings that had been built in their development pattern. And it would have been the greatest hope to have all the best parts kept and simply infill where we had nothing or where there were very poor building sites. We would have had an extremely rich architectural city.
It'd be marvelous.
It'd be entirely different than it is today.
And this is taking me back. My wife and I lived in London for several months a few years ago
mm-hmm.
in one of the historic Georgian squares.
Well,
there,
wonderful.
The delightful thing of seeing the old buildings there.
Right.
Makes me feel what was lost here. It's
yeah.
incredible. Back a bit on the foundries, this is quite a set of information. Is all that foundry stuff from newspapers? Or did you ever find some archives or records? Or did your student ever really find any papers of the foundries? Or is this all reconstructed from newspaper accounts?
It's all pulled together
yeah?
from... Now, there were no records whatsoever in the foundries themselves,
yeah.
those that survive today. But there were private papers from, for instance, the Failing family, the Corbett family, that mentioned some of their associations with foundries. My immediate tie to the foundries is the Phoenix Iron Works, where my great-grandfather had one of the first foundries in San Francisco. I knew that he had something to do with iron, but all my growing up, it was iron safes. As I investigated the papers of Absalom Halleck, the city's first architect. In it, the very first building that Halleck built had Kittredge's Phoenix Ironwork on it. So I discovered my own great-grandfather had played a role in the first...
Jonathan Kittredge?
Jonathan Kittredge.
Okay, and this is unbeknownst to you.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
And in a letter that I had at home that I never even noticed, I found the Phoenix Ironwork stationery, Labor Omnia Vinci.
Okay.
Dear wife and little ones. So it was kind of fun.
Yeah.
I don't think this foundry is still going. There's one in Oakland, just possibly.
Huh.
I'd like to go down and poke around someday.
Yeah.
I'd very much like to go down to San Francisco, and I can't remember his name right now. There's a fellow at the University of California whom I met at an architectural historians meeting who knew all of the San Francisco foundries and particularly knew the Phoenix Ironworks, and I can hardly wait to go visit him
see
what he has to say.
Yeah. Well, how did you become aware of the Friends of Cast Iron group in New York? Is that my right? That's your pattern?
Yes. Well, I had lunch with, I was having lunch with two friends and kind of talking about the dilemma of the few artifacts that are left of this whole period simply disappearing to barbecues and over-metal doodads. And that if there were an organization that could buy this, a non-profit organization, keep them in one place until they might be used or put in a public place, at least there'd be something left of that whole era. So we sat down to think how we could put a group together. Of course, it's good to be more complex than that. We wrote the New York group and asked them if they'd consider a Western branch of their group. And they were all very, very amenable to that. But the dilemma came when we wanted to buy things, so they had no facility in there, the way they're set up to buy anything.
They don't?
No.
On their own?
No. They're not a non-profit corporation, I don't believe. Anyway, we had very much wanted to be directly associated with them, but we decided the only way we could accomplish our purpose was to set up our own group. So we simply said, Portland, Friends of Cast Iron Architecture. Of course, we've kept in very close contact with the New York group. Some marvelous people. Margot Gale is just an institution in herself.
Hmm. How do you spell her last name?
G-A-Y-L-E.
G-A-Y-L-E.
I wish I had her book, but I think it's at home.
Okay.
She's very flamboyant, loving soul, just a tremendous woman.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we got an attorney to set up a little corporation for us. And it is the attorney's wife, Karen Curley, who was the editor on this.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill took that information home about our group. They joined, and it was really a year later that when I was talking to Bill, that said, well, my wife is looking for something to do, and she has tremendous background in editing, and if you're interested in a book, maybe you'd be interested in talking to her.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, and the book was gone.
Launch. All this has led you kind of unexpected directions, or at least in more detail than you might have thought.
Fun.
Yeah,
oh,
great. Well, now the current membership of the group. What is your structure? Your do you have membership fees or how does it go?
$5 brings you a little membership card with a magnet on it. Like the New York group, we took a lot of the fun things that they've got.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a newsletter, which has been very slow lately because the book's been everywhere.
You've been doing the newsletter.
Yeah. Well, we'll get to that. And there's the chance for a little museum is very strong right now. A local businessman, Bill Nato, is going to offer some space for it. And the museum really will probably be a joint project of the Junior League, with two people in particular who are really driving forces on this. And perhaps the Chinese community. And maybe some people are interested in the waterfront history. And it's hopeful that even though it would be very small, it could be a place to go in the historic district that would show the tremendous vitality of the early city. That's a good lesson because we're totally abandoned now at night. It's a very vital,
mm-hmm.
alive city now, people living in it. So it would be a lesson in history, and I think it would be a fun thing to have in the city. People do seem to enjoy history.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any prospects of putting some of what you've bought back on the buildings as they're restored?
Oh, yes, we have.
You have
some
done
things
that
have been given to us, which we in turn have given to an owner. Things that we buy, we would mm-hmm. sell to them at that price.
Yeah. Can you think of any specific buildings?
Well, the Mikado building over here has a...
Mikado is...
As in the
Mikado?
Gilbert and Sullivan,
yeah.
Right?
The Mikado building has...
I mentioned that in here.
Okay.
The Mikado block. That'd be 1880. The corner pilasters on that building came from a building that was demolished across the street for the new PGE project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Although they don't match the other ones, they were the right height and went back here to kind of finish off the building as it originally had been.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's the type of thing that we could do.
Mm-hmm.
There are some street lanterns we were given once, and we gave those to Bill Nato, who will use them in his Old Town project.
What exactly does he have in mind down there? Is he going to restore a large area of Old Town?
Well, he owns the Merchants Hotel,
yeah.
The 1880 building that has a lot of cast iron on it. He owns the Norton Hotel building. He owns the, let's see, two or three other buildings down there in front, some of which have tremendous restoration potential. And he's very interested in this. Matter of fact, he just bought several of these books, and I'm hoping that my little message in here of what could be done to them will play a role.
Well, have you been...
Could I call him back? Wherever it be.
Have you been given most of the Pickles stuff?
Hmm? This facade is entirely bricked up at the moment.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. But he is planning to expose these cast iron columns. They're very, very handsome columns.
I think so.
They're right there, and the original doors, right behind the bricked up facade.
Are they brick over, brick between?
There's a new brick facade.
New brick facade on that building.
Oh, it's put in the 40s, the great era.
And all that's still in it, all behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. The architects in the 40s were not interested in our city's historic past. It was an era when if you were going to be a good contemporary architect, you rejected what had been as a false architecture, which is unfortunate. It's the way that every architectural style comes along, whichever is the one that's current, the one that was passed is always in disfavor.
Yeah.
And it was unfortunate because while other cities would simply leave their good buildings, we tore them down. And it was felt completely justified to destroy the city's historic architecture, to replace it with absolutely severe buildings, because that was our time. I think that attitude is changing, that the richness of a city is its variety and not its one-facedness, facetness.
Have you been given most of the stuff you have on hand, your stuff for your museum and so forth, or have you met?
A lot of it. We bought it. We spent over $9,000 or $10,000.
Yeah. How have you raised the money to do this?
Well, our membership fee brings in a little regular.
That's $5 a year.
$5 a year.
Yeah.
But it's enough to make two or three purchases a year.
Mm-hmm.
The big purchases, such as 12-foot columns like this, have come from the Metropolitan Arts Commission and the Historic Landmarks Commission. One was a $5,000 grant, and the other was thousands, I can't remember exactly, which allowed us to make a significant purchase, such as six columns. We have another six of that set to buy, which we hope to do sometime, but at the moment, unless we get more grants, it will have to be on a one column per year basis.
You've been buying these things as demolition goes on?
Yes.
That been,
well, for instance, this building, which was the west side of the Skidmore Fountain square, the original square, these columns are available because someone bought them from the demolished building. They are enormous, great big, huge columns. We have about six of them now. We are interested in buying the other six, which of course is thousands of dollars worth of ironwork and artwork.
What building is that?
This was the New Market Block North Wing
that
Captain Ankeny built in 1873.
Mm-hmm.
This was a contained square and the most handsome square on the West Coast when you might have said we had a little art city. It had a 2- and 3-story scale to it, narrow streets, completely unified by cast iron arches and columns all the way around. It's extremely handsome little square, and our opera house was on it.
Yeah, I've seen
most
the
significant
opera house,
in the northwest, and out of San Francisco.
Yeah. Where do you have your treasures stashed at the moment?
Well, we've. The city was a little reluctant to store it, they worry about it a lot, so we ended up putting it on some farm property out in the country. And it's just in a big row in the field out there, but it's all right. It takes an awful lot of weathering to affect this ironwork.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have a cast iron fountain in the next room, which I can show you.
In the next room?
We have lots of small artifacts, like keystones and medallions. And
Julie, how many items total do you have again?
About 150.
Mm-hmm.
I have the catalog list here.
Oh, you do? Good. I wonder if I could
see
that. Is
there
a copy?
Cast iron piece. It's
mm-hmm.
a keystone that went across on the top of a window. This is our little fountain. Another keystone. These are upper floor decorations that were put in the spandrel between arches or in some way decorated a window. Keystones. This is a piece that it decorated maybe a horizontal belt cornice or some sort of little tablature over a doorway or something. These were little pieces that were on a large column. Most of the columns were cast in one piece, but the very, very fine decoration was cast in separate pieces and bolted to it. Because it would be a swag that was would go down between windows in some way. More keystones.
Scrolls,
that's
there.
Right. We have a few pieces of hardware. One stained glass window that needs repair badly. This is a decoration that was found at the belt cornice between the main floor and the second floor, and there's a big cornice in it through here.
Mm-hmm.
These are our columns. The scale is all strange here because this is a great big column. This is a little
tiny
right. piece.
What are those, 12 footers or something?
Yeah,
like
this
there?
Is
yeah.
12 feet and this is only about 2.
Yeah.
These
I see a letter, mailbox letter plate back there,
yeah.
too. Look kind of fancy.
These were given to us by the PGE project.
Huh.
The enormous sheet metal decorations that are absolutely superb.
Now, they're triangular?
They were triangular pieces that went up just below the cornice line on either side of a big round arched window.
Huh.
Very, very handsome pieces of craftsmanship.
Would they be pressed? Sheet metal? What is that? Let's see.
Well, they might have put them in a form somehow,
yeah.
but they were mostly just soldered together pieces, and it's a very rich three-dimensional thing.
Hmm.
These are the date, of course, was always on these buildings, or the owner's name. They were very proud of the building.
Sheet metal letters.
Yeah, a nice thing to do on a building. It's one of the nicest we don't care about anymore. More columns. It's a heat grill that we found the rubble over here.
Mm-hmm.
There are interior columns, too, which had a large T-section of scrolls that supported a large wooden beam.
Carried a beam
on the
there.
Inside.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
We have quite a few of these interior columns. They're very, very handsome. More keystones. Sometimes we will find we're beginning to get sets. For instance, this is one that we had before, and we're getting 5 or 6 of that time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Brackets and heads. Heads were always a very sought-after item. So we're getting a collection of heads. This is a balcony that came from an enormous building on 3rd Avenue.
The
Abington
building?
Old Abington.
1886.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the last cast iron buildings.
That is an entire complete balcony in one chunk?
Yeah, it's sheet metal, cast iron, and wood, all in one.
Very
rich. It needs a lot of repair, but it's still a marvelous artifact to have. More keystones. These are the very large columns that we bought from Eric Ladd. They're absolutely enormous and very, very handsome gutsy columns. Tremendous feats for cast iron.
From the Ankeny building.
From the Ankeny building. That's the one.
Well,
actually, this is Ankeny's New Market Block North Wing.
Oh, yeah.
It used to be called Ankeny.
Yeah, building. The one you showed me in the book.
Right.
Thing. Yeah.
Right. Of course, there were windowsills and door thresholds, whole window casings were sometimes in cast iron. This is a cast iron ventilator grill from that Ankeny's New Market Block North Wing. Very handsome casting, very well done.
Mm-hmm.
Roof railings were all cast iron. We only have one example of that. We liked it. There were hundreds of them in the city. We'd like to have some more examples of those.
Now, did they run around the exact top of the building?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see in this.
Yeah.
I've got a drawing. Here's one on the
block. Okay, right.
It was a detail to keep you from falling off the top, of course, but
mm-hmm.
here's one on the Labaise block, a very very handsome one.
Mm-hmm.
Barely shows in the photographs. The buildings of the late 70s and 80s had cast iron railings on the roof. And they added a very rich fancy to the top with finials. And it was just a marvelous meeting of the sky. The whole idea of a building meeting the sky is just not a factor anymore. It's rectilinear block meeting the sky, period. The idea of a transition is no longer of significance to architects. Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Unless we express the elevator and the vents and the flues and everything.
Yeah, right.
This is one of the richest buildings within the city.
Which one is that?
Well, it was the Strobridge block, right next to the Corbett block, but the combination of these two was that cornice line is just exceptionally fine. Very, very beautiful building. This was a three-story facade of cast iron. The Corbett building of 1870 was the only one that was shipped around the Horn. Came many years before this one. No, just a few years before this one. But that was more typical of the cast iron work in the East, where you ordered a whole facade from a building. Local manufacturers concentrated on the lower floor, cast iron with a masonry building and cast iron decorations on above. It was much less expensive. But the buildings that had cast iron 3 floors high had tremendous light potential. It could open the whole facade to light.
Hmm.
It was all the structure and the analysis of iron was used in steel buildings at farm. So it played a very important role in the development of American architecture.
Mm-hmm.
I have some tables of the iron, all the strength ratios and so forth for iron. And they're really remarkably similar to what it would be today.
Why was the ironwork here so elaborate by our standards? It's playful, it's a lot of other things. How did that express the era or whatever, I wonder? What do you feel on that?
Well, it was we were still part of a classic tradition in this country. Out of the Greek revival of the East, that period, there came a very, it's sort of the federal style of architecture that came west, I would say. Very tall, elegant proportions on buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no alternative to a classical facade in those days. You had cornices and traditional windows, and arches were a way of solving a structural problem. The city had none of the artisans that could make these things when they started out, but if they had one artist and a foundry, they could carve one pattern and have 3 or 4 blocks of the same column and arch design, which they did. So it gave a tremendous unity to the early city, just rows after rows of beautiful arches, much like Venice is, the spirit of long rows of columns, and a very elegant, tall style of architecture.
It's really rather a marvelous coincidence of timing, isn't it, that Portland begins to grow and cast iron is there to be used, the techniques and the foundries.
Well, 1850s was the beginning of the development of iron architecture in the country, and that's when we were founded. So our early growth coincided exactly.
Mm-hmm.
The iron was thought to, of course, be the material of the future. So a tremendous investment was made in local iron foundries, and there were dozens of foundries at that point. Ore was available out of Oswego, so they had the material. They were thinking that Oswego would become the Pittsburgh of the West, which it did not. Everything was here to make Portland a unique architectural experience.
Where did their coal come from?
They used wood.
Used wood, I see.
Local wood around Oswego to make the charcoal.
Mm-hmm. So it was all here.
Yeah, it's all here.
Yeah. Let's run through the inventory a bit more. These faces, did they go above doors? Is that the notion? Or?
Well, a typical decoration, let's see. For instance, this piece, a medallion from...
a head medallion.
From the Deacom and Reed block, that was 1872. Let me turn to that for a minute. That piece is right here on the edging.
Oh, yeah.
Placed, bolted into the brick and the spandrel between the two arches.
Mm-hmm.
This building was considered one of the most significant on the West Coast when it was built, surpassing anything in San Francisco. It was two of the big families in the city went together to build this.
Is this the Reed of Reed College, Simeon Reed?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Right. It was that money that founded Reed College.
Mm-hmm.
There aren't any Deacons left that I know of.
Mm.
There was a daughter for years who simply lived on forever. I happened to interview her when I was working on George's book. She was at that point where she could remember my great uncle before he died in 1906.
Yeah.
So she spanned the whole city.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, this ironwork, there were five columns left on it. And the first item we had to purchase were to be these five columns and their arches. Beautiful piece of craftsmanship. And they were only a couple of $100 available on a lot on the east side. By the time we'd approached every group in town to solicit money, by the time we'd become incorporated, which is only a matter of weeks, someone decided that the iron in those columns was worth more, broken up and re-smelted, recast. So we lost them. And we went out to a foundry when they were still breaking them up in a very dramatic meeting that we had. We had, by that point, paid a down deposit on the iron, and so there's been some horrible mistake. The person who said you could use this iron was not the owner of the iron, and we demand to get it, and so forth and so on. Well, it just became a huge entanglement. The person was outraged that we should approach him and broke up the rest of the columns immediately so that we wouldn't have anything to discuss. That was a very informative beginning for a group interested in saving some artifacts of the city's past. That really the interest in these things has been very, very low. And when it becomes popular, or it's become fairly popular now, many people are investing in old buildings. So then there becomes a general public awareness, I think, of what we have, what we destroy.
How about some of the things you have managed to say? What are the stories behind them? How do you become aware of them? Or how do you go about snatching these from other...
Oh, someone will call us.
Demolishers.
Someone wrote us from Cannon Beach that this head was available. We drove down, beautiful head. It cost some bucks, but...
it was down in Cannon Beach?
Right. In that gift shop down there.
Mm-hmm.
And we used the Metropolitan Arts Commission grant last year to buy that.
Do you have some favorite pieces out of here that were particularly hard to get? Or?
Well, I think the classic faces are among the most fun. They're very elegant decorations that peered out on the city. Tremendous luxury in the carving that was on these buildings. For instance, on the Cam block, one of the richest facades that the city ever had, with towers and finials and cast iron balusters and a whole bit. There were some enormous Baroque carvings on that building that were really extraordinary. Some Herculean figures, the caryatids that were herms, they were called, decorated the main entry portal. Very, very impressive. It looked like Baroque
Vienna.
What were they called again?
Herms, H-E-R-M-E-N.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
Up on the roof cornice, there were some female Herms, bosoms flying in the whole bed, supporting this enormous pediment up here. Those, we had a little fundraising effort to buy these, which were still left in the city, and they are now in the foyer on the west side of the Pioneer Courthouse. All the bosoms were replaced and broken hands and everything by a local woodcarver, and they at least are safe. Uh-huh. But it's that type of thing that disappears so fast.
Yeah. When you were growing up here in Portland as a kid, were you aware of the old area of town?
I was. Both my grandfathers had offices in these buildings, but I was too young I wasn't aware of it when they were coming down. I was tiny when my grandfather was alive, and I think I was very aware by high school that we were losing a tremendous amount of our city. And more and more and more.
Let's see, that would have been the 50s when it was really...
50s, yeah.
Really was coming
down. The 50s when it was all on its way. And it's just a shame that our culture is such that we appreciate things too late. If we had inherited the Parthenon, we would have torn it down for a parking lot before we realized that it was significant for a culture or a city or whatever. It's a little sad.
Portland seems to have more parking lots than other cities I've been around. Is that fair to say?
There is an impressive statement in our parking lots.
Yeah.
They're everywhere. And the idea for all the city plans that came up in the 30s and 40s was that we were tearing down to build a new city, a very handsome new city, and beautiful plans were drawn. Waterfront, the Burnham plan, all those people. Of course, they tore down, but they didn't build a thing, so we were left with nothing except more parking lots.
Yeah. Did the Depression rather run plans off the track, I wonder, or?
Well, the river was abandoned. We turned our back on the river for decades. Mm-hmm. It had been our beginnings and our commerce, and everything that we relied on, or everything by which we gained, was due to the river in the early years. But when the city moved uptown, they were moving to the more prestigious buildings and mm-hmm. the new high-rises with fancy elevators. And it wasn't old enough to be considered a heritage. People did not use that term. Yeah. There was no such thing in Portland in those days.
Yeah. Do you know if the decision, well, I don't know if it was even a decision, but the move from the Willamette to the Columbia, was that a Port Commission policy, or was there a...
Impossible to accommodate the city's commerce on its waterfront. It wasn't enough room.
Mm-hmm. The sheer growth really forced it.
Oh, everything needed a huge new scale to it.
Okay, so there are cast iron heads. I saw a cast iron bracket.
Yeah, that was
over here.
Probably supported. Well, I don't know what that piece was. It's too hard to tell it.
Mm-hmm.
Our latest.
We went past one page here. Let's see.
These are the light standards that we were given.
Oh, yeah.
And these were some pieces of the Ladd building, but all of that, the rest of that ironwork, is reinstalled in the Benjamin Franklin, the Franklin Plaza over here.
Mm.
I did a drawing of that building before it came, from old photographs. And it was my hopes that this set of ironwork could be put back on a building in the historic district. Well, the owners had saved it and were not interested in putting on a new building, but did put all of these pieces in their executive suite on the top floor of the Franklin Plaza. This drawing was enlarged to enormous scale as part of their decoration.
Mm-hmm.
These are the latest things we've been given. This is a terracotta piece, which not really our era, but They're very fine terracotta pieces that came in the late 1890s, and some interior columns, which would be very handsome outside somewhere, supporting something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes 150 pieces. We now have a grant from, another grant from the Metropolitan Arts Commission, and we're trying to find something suitable for them. They've been very, very supportive of us.
Mm-hmm. What size is this grant? Is it big enough?
Oh, a few $100.
Uh-huh, yeah.
They don't have the thousands that we start out with. They have a fabulous program of support of the arts in the city. But there's just so much they can give to Kickstarter.
Well, what do you think the future of restoration is here? Let's see, you have about 20 existing buildings out of a couple hundred cast iron buildings. Is that...
Well, it's a big question, what happens to our historic districts. What do you pass on to the future in the 20th century? What is the development face of a city in this time? I personally would like to see something passed on that would be enough to show that we had a very sophisticated early city here. Otherwise, that memory would be totally obliterated. And if it's possible to put a few infill projects using the cast iron that's still in the city, I would support that very much. Now, this is not saying that we must rebuild our cities in a Victorian way. I think that would be absurd. But I do think that the richness and interest of a city depends upon those various eras that have added to it real quality. So that I personally would feel be perfectly valid to have a few facades put up and give a little district, a little area, some architectural unity. For instance, our new market theater's next to a parking lot. I think that's obscene when it was our art square of the 70s and 80s. We have those columns for that missing block. That should go back. We have the columns that were across the street, and perhaps something could be put up to a wall around the, I shouldn't say we have, they are available in the city. Perhaps a wall could be put up around the fire station that would disguise a very ugly building and give a little street scale to that area right around the fountain. Mm-hmm. There are several other facades that could be put up right around there. Very modest brick buildings, but all their cast iron would be featured. And it would give that moduled effect, column arch effect that was the early city. And no more than that. I think that would be enough to pass on.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the city would never had a district. There's the terracotta city is dispersed all over the place. And those great buildings should be saved. And they are certainly handsome with very good contemporary buildings
yeah.
next to them.
Who's going to start the Friends of Terracotta? Is that your next project?
There, is it? No, not me. My bit. But Virginia Faraday is thinking of writing a book on that era.
Uh-huh. I see.
And I hope that will bring a lot of mm-hmm. publicity to another very valid time in the city's architectural history.
Bill, I know you've done so much of this cast iron stuff yourself, but are there other people you can think of who have lent a hand, kept an eye out, or so forth in saving the stuff, making special efforts? Who are some of the other activists,
well,
if there are any?
Someone who was very significant years ago when it was coming down is named Eric Ladd. He saved many, many of the facades.
Is he of the historic Ladd?
No, he's not. No, there's no connection. He saved some of the facades at a time when it was not fashionable. And still available.
Is he a builder? Or?
He was a local builder who was enthusiastic about the city's architecture. That iron is still with us.
Is he still alive?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he's willing to sell it to us. He wanted to see something done to all these artifacts so they'd be saved. And that never was realized. But I think maybe with this renewed interest in the city's past and the bicentennial year and all, that there might be someone who would actually use these things.
Do you have your own kind of network of friends who tell you when things show up in antique shops?
Oh, there are a lot of people who have who have collected cast iron pieces, and they're all very much a part of our group, or things from that era. Benny Mulligan and Jerry Bosco have helped us with flatbed trucks and cranes and all that stuff. They have a knowledge of how to take the parts off the building and get them onto a truck and take them out the country.
That's right. This is not easy stuff to handle, is it?
Well, let me tell you, swinging around the end of a 13-foot column is a hairy experience.
What does something like that weigh?
Over a ton.
Over a ton.
Yeah. It's big stuff for someone who has a bad back.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, lots of people I can mention. I can't get all their names out now. Mm-hmm.
No, that's fine.
But what's very heartening is how many people appear at our meetings, our annual meetings.
Where do you?
Who would really like to see something done to our historic district. And that has been quite an argument for the Historic Landmarks Commission, that there are people out here that are supportive of these projects in this city. And there are a complete spectrum from terribly wealthy people to our mailman, who's a member.
You're our mailman.
Yeah.
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 Where do you hold your meetings and when?
The old church, once a year.
Is that the church up here by the
right.
historic?
They give us a little helpful gesture on the cost of the hall.
Mm-hmm. What time of year do you usually have it? Is there?
Well, it's supposed to be in the early summer, but this year it was months late because of the book. We wanted the book to be available.
Yeah.
The book was supposed to be ready for the meeting, and it went on. Mm-hmm. Finally, we had it late October.
Okay. Now, if I want to stroll around and look at some of the stuff, I ought to go look at the Mikado building that you've put back up. You showed me, I think I could pick it out of the book. From
the Harker building across the street from it.
Harker?
Harker building.
Okay.
And going down the street, the building next to it, those are buildings of the 60s. The Pierne building and the Dr. Poppleton's building, these are all buildings of the mid-60s. And there's some buildings of the 70s. This is in the Yamhill Historic District, right over here. I'll show you where these things are. The Newmarket Theater is our greatest historic landmark. It's just made a tremendous announcement that it's going to be restored.
Is that right?
Millions of dollars going into it.
Hmm. Where's that money coming from?
From, it's called the Skidmore Development Group.
Hmm.
And you may be interested in talking to the guy who's responsible for that. The people who own the property and the Skidmore Development Group are making an enormous investment in that building.
Hmm. Who would I talk to?
Al Soltheim. He's in the Mikado block, so
is
I see.
Sol, S-O-L?
S-O-L-H-E-I-M, I think.
H-E-I.
Right.
S-O-L.
Right.
Okay.
I may have the name of the company a little off. But that is going to be the major development project in the historic district. There's another. The Failing Building of 1885, has just been restored by the architects Wolf, Gunsel, and Frasca, and they've done an extremely handsome job on that building. That building is right here. It's an old etching of it. This is the way it was when the book was published, and now all this has just been beautifully redone.
Okay.
And that is extremely handsome on the inside.
First and Oak, that is, huh?
Right. The northwest corner of the intersection of First and Oak.
Okay.
The Simon Building has just been fixed up. These are three major buildings of 1883. That's this building. It's been repainted. It's been repainted, but not nearly as attractively as the Failing Building. The Failing Building's very, very handsome. And there's quite a few buildings on the other side of Burnside that have had a lot of work done on them.
Mm-hmm.
The Blagan Block has just had a new paint job. I could give you an instant tour of these things.
Well, I don't know. Do you have time?
Let me look at my calendar.
Yeah, thanks.